Okay, we're going to start. So welcome back to week three. Those that are here, Zoom, Facebook, we're all over the place, which is okay. We, in the series of lessons from 2020, eat the fruit, throw away the peel. Today's topic is responses, collective response and individual response, which will become clear when I explain it. So let's just do a little bit of review on last week. So last week we talked about morality in general, and we talked about the fact that 2020 brought out the best and the worst of people. A year of chaos, but depending on how you deal with it and how you respond to it, and we talked a lot about the Rabbi Sacks model of shifting from the we to the I, when unfortunately society has done the other way around, which linked into the whole idea of listening on many levels. We talked about Judaism being a culture of listening rather than seeing. Seeing is when you observe, there's clarity, but you're only observing, you're not engaged, you're distanced, you're detached. Whereas listening is you're much more engaged, you explore, you connect, nuanced, and so on. So we tend to look at the bigger picture, and we brought in this idea, obviously that happens on all levels, but it happens with governments and everyone. And even when it talked about experts, we said it's good people should listen to the experts, but the experts listen to the people, and how that all works. Okay, so that was just a bit of review from last week. Now, before I go on today, I want to just mention, we talked about Purim. So Purim is next week. So next Thursday, we're having a lesson as normal. But Thursday night and Friday is Purim. So we are having over here, there have been various different Megillah readings. For those that want, you can check with the office the times. But I also wanted to mention, in addition to that, the next Friday morning at 9:30, we're going to be having a little quick Megillah reading and a bit of a Purim morning tea at the home of Ariela Spiridis, which is in Vaucluse. The only thing is, because of the continued situation that we're in, a very good situation in Sydney, but nevertheless, still with a bit of restrictions and rules and guidance, so I'd really like to invite everyone, but if you can make sure that you just tell the office, email, phone, text, or whatever the case is, if you're coming, they'll give you the exact address, and then come along and enjoy, just because we need to know numbers, because there is a restriction of 30 guests in a home, which you want to try and keep, so we've got to keep the rules. Okay. But we will have some Megillah readings here as well that you can check with the office. They've got all the times that I know offhand, but yeah, check with them. Okay, so what I want to deal with today is responses, which means like this, that when I want to just sort of have a bit of a reflection on how we respond to different things that happen in the world. But what I really want to get to, and I'll get to it later on, is highlighting the difference between what I call collective responses and individual responses, and how important that is. Okay. But before we do that, I want to just come back to the fundamental importance of this whole discussion, of why it is so important to respond in general, right? When something happens, we have to respond, not only while it's happening, but even beyond, which is really the foundation of the series. But I want to just highlight it a bit more today. Based on something that the Rambam Maimonides talks about, but also a thought from Rabbi Sacks. And just to begin this way, you know, 2020, the events of 2020, right, kind of were so significant that it sort of forced us into a response. So people had to respond, at least governments had to respond, countries had to respond, right? And it was, in other words, it was a type of year that you just cannot ignore. I mean, like someone, I was just with someone last night, he said, well, if you lived through 2020, you've seen everything. Like, you know, you can't ignore it, right? You can't ignore that it was different. But the truth is that it shouldn't only be that way. It should be even when something less significant happens, or when anything happens, individually or collectively, that we should respond. Because, as the Rambam says, we base it on a very fundamental principle. And the fundamental principle is that everything that happens in the world from a Jewish point of view is bashkacha pratit, is divine providence, right? Which means, by extension, not only happens by divine providence, it means everything has a purpose, right? Now, I use the word purpose on intentionally. I was going to say purpose on purpose, right? I use the word purpose intentionally. Because when I say that, I use the word purpose, but not reason. Why? Because everything does have a reason. Obviously, nothing happens without a reason. But that's not relevant, as we've spoken about many, many times, right? Because it's not relevant to us. Often God doesn't want us to know the reason, nor should we try and explore the reason. We may never know the reason. It might not be relevant, the reason. But everything has a purpose. That is relevant. In other words, while we cannot find out the purpose, the reason of anything, or lots of things, we can respond with the purpose of what happened. It's a very big difference. Yeah, you with me? Because the reason might not be related to the purpose, or the reason might be for us to find purpose, or might be something else as well, which we don't know, right? And the purpose, we do have a way of finding out the purpose, because there could be multi-purposes. What I mean to say is that when we give meaning or purpose to something challenging that happens, it might not be the same for every person. Now, we have guidance, we have principles, we have Torah principles, we have Jewish principles that guide us sort of how we respond and what are the types of things we do and what's the direction of our response, and it could be many things and many different focuses, but it doesn't have to be the same for everyone. So everything happens for a purpose, which means that sometimes we get to decide. Now, when I say decide, I don't mean completely decide, because obviously we need to follow lessons and guidelines of morality and purpose, but we get to decide which area of focus we're going to do. And then we give it the purpose that it was meant for. Because the worst thing that we can do is to ignore something that happens. Because when we ignore, what we're saying is that God made it happen, because everything's bashka chapratit. God brought it upon us, made it happen, whether it's good or not so good, whatever the case is. But it has a purpose, and we fulfill that purpose. If we don't, we're kind of responding to God and saying, well, it's a waste of time. Which is unfortunate, right? Because nothing's a waste of time. Everything's there for a purpose. The reason, maybe not, we don't know, but the purpose we do. And Rabbi Sacks, in one of the articles, which he wrote actually at the beginning of the isolation period of COVID, just very shortly before he passed away, he said, let us listen carefully to what the Talmud says. Because he said there's a saying in the Talmud, a very interesting saying in the Talmud, which he gives a nice twist to it. A famous saying which says, "Chashper Roshoya Sok Betorah." If someone has a headache, he should learn Torah. Now, I don't know about you, but the last time I had a headache, I took 2 Panadol. In fact, if you try learning a piece of Talmud when you have a headache, it's probably not a good idea, because you probably won't understand it. Better to take 2 Panadol first. And if you do, it might not work. But what it does mean is, I think on a deeper meaning is, if something's happening, there's a challenging thing that's hurting your head that you don't understand, it's complex, you're struggling to find direction, focus, and so on and so forth, look in the Torah, you'll find the answer. You'll find the direction, you'll find a bit of a framework with which to respond, right? And he starts off with this. The first framework is, the first focus is that it's not by chance. And when he wrote this article, it was the beginning of the book of Vayikra. It's a beautiful idea. I'm going to share it with you, even though it's not the parasha of the week or anything, but it's just a beautiful concept. So it was the book of Vayikra. Vayikra begins, it's a long book, talks about the laws of Kohanim, and it's the laws of Leviticus, laws of Levim, sacrifices, rituals in the temple, and so on and so forth. But it starts off by saying, Vayikra el Moshe, and God called Moshe. He called him. As Rashi says, because when God would speak to Moses, he would call him first. It was like a relationship. He wouldn't just speak to him, he would call him as if to say, we're connected, and he would create that context of preciousness, and then he would continue to tell him what he wanted to tell him. But there's a very famous thing in that word Vayikra. Vayikra ends with the letter Aleph. That's how you write it in Hebrew, Vayikra, right? Now, I don't know if you know this, but in the Tanakh, throughout the whole Tanakh, we have a tradition that all the letters of the Aleph base are at least once throughout the Tanakh written smaller than the rest, and at least once written bigger. Okay? The Aleph of Vayikra is a small Aleph. If you open up a Torah scroll, you'll see it says Vav Yud Kuf Resh, and the Aleph is very tiny, right? Much smaller than the rest of the word. Which means whichever size the words are, the Aleph is smaller, right? What's the significance? Because we find that when God speaks to not such good people, like the famous story of Bilam in the Torah, and it doesn't say Vayikra, he didn't call Bilam, it says Vayikar, he chanced upon Bilam. Right, he happened to meet him. Right, so there's a very big similarity between Vayikar and Vayikra. Vayikra means he called, right? And Vayikar means he chanced upon. Now, which means that God is saying to us, when he calls us, the way Rabbi Sacks explains it, is Vayikra, he's calling to us, he's saying to us, engage. There's a lesson here, there's a purpose, there's a relationship, there's guidance, there's a way forward, right? In other words, when I give you something, not only when he calls Moshe Rabbeinu, God is calling every person. In any event that happens in the world, it's a call. However, the Aleph is small, so it's very easy to confuse it with Vayikar. You know, we can respond to it and say, well, it just happened, it's a coincidence, right? We can miss the Aleph, and we shouldn't do that. And he connects it with something that happens at the very end of the book of Vayikra, right? Where there's a very harsh part of the Torah there, where God tells us we better behave, we better do what he says, and otherwise there'll be consequences, and so on and so forth. And there's a word there that appears very often. In fact, it appears very often in that parasha, and doesn't appear anywhere else in the Torah. And the word is keri, same word, keri. Keri means, so God says, like every few sentences, he says, well, if you don't listen after I've done this to you, and you keep responding to me, v'halachta imi b'keri, and you keep behaving with keri, and what does that mean? So keri means haphazard, chance. Same word, vayikar, right? So what God is saying, that it's an unbelievable lesson. God is saying like this, I'm going to protect you. I'm going to watch you. I'm going to reward you. I'm going to look after you in a supernatural way. As we know, the Jewish people's existence is supernatural. But if you keep responding to me by chance, I'm going to leave you to chance. And then you're in trouble. Right? So, we have a very similar story with Purim, right? You know, they say that Purim, the Jews were punished with Haman because they enjoyed the banquet of Ahasuerus. Right? He doesn't bring this in the article, but it's a famous idea where, and the commentaries ask, I mean, it couldn't have been, I mean, first of all, the Medrash says that the banquet of Ahasuerus was kosher. So, what was the transgression? What was the problem? They went to a banquet? I mean, what was the issue, right? But if you look carefully at the wording, it says they nehenu, they enjoyed the banquet. What does it mean? That the Jews at the time didn't do anything wrong. What they did, they sort of forgot who looks after them. And they started responding to the world as everything is chance, and therefore we better do the politically right thing, we better go to Ahasuerus, we better make sure we're good friends with him and good buddies with him, because that's the source of our protection, right? Pure nature, pure coincidence, pure randomness. Now, of course, you've got to do the responsible thing, but you always have to remember that's not where the blessing comes from. So therefore, God responded and he said, okay, no problem. If that's the way you want to operate, go ahead. I'll let things run the course. Let things run the course. You have Ahasuerus is your friend today. Tomorrow, there's a Haman, right? And then they realized the mistake and they reconnected, so God also reconnected, right? That was the story of Purim. I just thought I'd throw that in because it's Purim next week. It's a good lesson. But here he goes back to the same thing. So therefore, the Rambam, where does the Rambam bring this? The Rambam brings this when he talks about things that happen in the world that aren't so good in a revealed way. And this is in the laws. The Rambam is a book of laws, of course, and this is in the laws of fasting, because, you know, we have our fast days throughout the year, but there's also a concept, particularly when there were more established communities, where if something happened, like there was a drought, or there was a trouble, or there was a pandemic, or whatever the case is, that the Beit Din at the time would proclaim fast days. We try not to do that nowadays too much because people find it very hard to fast. That's why you don't find so many proclaimed fast days, because we have difficulty dealing with the ones we have already. So, but same idea, we need to do something, extra prayers, extra charity, whatever the case is, right? So the Rambam says, why is that so important, this mitzvah of fasting, when something happens, to do tshuva, to reconnect with God? Because he says, this is the point. The point is, you cannot just respond and saying, well, it happened, so it happened. You know, every 100 years, a pandemic happens. It's a cycle. You know, every so often, there's a hurricane. Every so often, there's this. Every so often, that. You know, he says that's fundamentally against Jewish belief. It's nikra. Rambam uses the same words. Because what we need to do always is when something happens, and again, we've said this many, many times, but I just want to repeat it again because it's so important. It's so important that we shouldn't just walk away from this whole process as if back to normal. Everyone's looking for a life of back to normal. It shouldn't be back to normal. It should be back to better, not back to normal, right? Because 2020 is Vayikra. God is calling out in some measure. Just the Aleph is very small. So it's very, very dangerous. And it's very easy to miss the Aleph. and to miss that it's a call to action. We could just say, oh, Vayikar, it happened, it chanced upon us. Right? But we have to see the Aleph. We have to see the call. We have to make sure that there is a response. And that's the Vayikra with an Aleph. And therefore, we have to respond. Now, how we respond, there's many lessons as we're going through in the series. And if we take some of the lessons, or all the lessons, or each one takes a lesson that they feel that they can thrive in, that's okay. But we have to respond. Now, when we respond, right, obviously, there's an obvious thing, but just want to say it anyway. Particularly from a Jewish point of view, when we respond, a Jewish way of responding is not just to talk about it, not just to say what the purpose is, not just to philosophize about it, right? We know that the Jewish response always has to be action. It means we have to change our behavior. We have to change what we do. Not just what we think about. Yes, we've got to change our values, our perspective. That's all good, but it's all for the purpose. Judaism, on whether it's man to man, between man and God, whatever the case is, but Judaism is a religion of action. In fact, in Pirkei Avot, in the Ethics of the Fathers, it says about learning. You know, we always talk about the greatness of learning Torah, the greatness of Jewish learning, and it is. The Jewish learning is fundamental of Jewish experience, fundamental of Jewish continuity, fundamental of Jewish history. However, the Pirkei Avot said, what is learning? It says, Kol Ha'omer, anyone who says, Ein li ela Torah, that I just focus on learning. I'm not so fussed about the behavior. I'm not so fussed about the implementation or how it changes me as a person. You need to know, says the Pirkei Avot, Afilu Torah Ein Lo, he doesn't even have Torah. You cannot divorce learning from action. In fact, it's very interesting. In the Talmud, there's a famous debate. And the debate says, they had a debate, what's greater, study or action? Talmud or Ma'aseh, learning or behavior? So it says they had a discussion of different views, and they voted and they decided that learning is the most important thing. Why? Wait for the punchline. Why? Because learning brings to action. So then what's the most important thing? Right? Yes, so both things are true. In other words, we cannot know what to do unless we learn. So learning is the most important because it's the foundation. The perspective, our mindset is the most important thing. We've got to protect our mind. You know, there's an interesting little thing I'll share with you. You know, when Jacob was running away from his brother Esau after he stole the blessings, right? And Esau threatened to kill him. So Yaakov ran away, and he was on the way to the house of Lavan, where he found his two wives, Rachel and Leah. Now Lavan lived in Haran. It was a very immoral place, a very negative place, a toxic place. On the way, Yaakov, it says, he happened to come to the Temple Mount, and he slept there. Right? And he had the famous dream with the ladder and so on. So it says in the Chumash that when he slept there, he took stones and he put them around his head, right? So Rashi says that he put them around his head to protect him from wild animals. Now you don't have to be a genius to know that if you put stones around your head, that the other vital organs around your body that the animals could attack, right? I mean, it's not. So what does that mean? What do you put stones around his head? So some of the commentaries explain the following. They say, Yaakov knew is on the way to Lavan. Lavan is going to be a place of a spiritual jungle, where there's wild animals, spiritual wild animals, right? It's going to be a place of distorted values, a place of immorality, a place of bad thinking, toxicity, right? Yaakov knows the first thing you have to protect is your head. You've got to have the right vision, the right perspective, the right value. So yes, learning is the most important thing. You've got to have the right direction. You've got to look at the world correctly. Otherwise, if that doesn't happen, then we're finished. However, when we do look at the world correctly, we've got to make sure that it travels down, as we've spoken about many times, to the heart, to the action, because the lessons have to be implemented. Right? So, yes, Torah is the most important thing, but it's the most important thing because it brings to change, it brings to action. Okay. So we have to respond. Now, anything that happens, especially when it's a global event, right? There's two types of responses, and they're both important. One is a global response, a government response, a leadership response, a community response. And of course, that's touch and go, and it's very difficult. We saw it in 220. It's complex and difficult because actually no one knows exactly what to do, and no one still knows what to do exactly. I mean, we've learned a lot more, but we don't know exactly. And we all try our best, and we criticize, and we question, and we go along, and every country's tried its best and failed and succeeded, and whatever had to happen to the best of their ability has happened, right? And especially when it's something completely new. And of course, you know, that's community, that's at a big level, on a small level, so there's community responses, there's government responses, country responses, and so on. However, And that's critical, because obviously that's how the world runs, right? But equally important is individual response. And you know, we see this in the Jewish experience, in the very makeup of being Jewish. How do we see this? When the Torah was given at Mount Sinai, right? So that was the beginning of our nationhood, right? We became a nation at Mount Sinai. We know that. That's when God gave us 10 Commandments, and we Exodus from Egypt, what happened on Pesach, but then at Shavuot, we stood at Mount Sinai, we became a nation. So that was a very collective event, communal event. Yet we know that when God spoke the 10 Commandments, He used the singular. Anochi Hashem Elokecha, I am Hashem, your God. In Hebrew, it's in English it's the same for singular and plural, but in Hebrew it's different. Your Elokecha is your God, singular. Elokechem is your God, plural, right? So He's talking to 3 million people, and we believe all the future souls that are going to be there. And He says, Elokecha, your, singular. He's talking to an individual. Why? Because God is saying community, and I'm making you into a nation, nationhood, community, collectiveness is critically important. It's the power of the many. However, equally important is the power of the individual and the individual response. What are you doing as an individual? Are you making sure not to rely on everyone else? Are you understanding that your participation, your contribution, your input is critically important, right? And unfortunately, what happens is individual responses often get missed, and we kind of, for various reasons, right? First of all, individuals don't always know what to do and how to respond. Second of all, as individuals, we often think that what we do isn't significant. And that's a real problem, right? I know when I was a kid, they used to tell us a little story about one of these parables about a king coming to town. Oh, that's right. It was in a town that they had a lot of people living there that made beautiful wine, right? Very, very good wine. So they started how they're gonna honor the king. That the night before, they're gonna erect this huge barrel in a park, and every person should come with one cup of very, very expensive good wine and pour it into the barrel. And when the king comes, there'll be a big ceremony and reception at the park, and they'll open the faucet and they'll give the king a cup of this unbelievable wine that was in that town. So one guy decided the night before, he says, listen, there's like 300 people in this town, right? I need to give my cup of wine. I'll pour a cup of water. And 299 people, the wine will be fine. The problem is that everyone had the same chachma, as they say in Yiddish, right? So they tell the story that the next morning the king arrived with great fanfare. They open up the faucet, and out came some water, right? So the power of the individual is really, really important, and we should never rely on others, but we do tend to rely on other people, right? Mm-hmm. And also, individual responses sometimes are because we rely on communal responses, we rely on government responses, we rely on leadership responses. And for the individual, the response often is very hard to do because it means going beyond our comfort zone, doing things that perhaps we don't think as individuals we have the strength to do, right? You know, last night, and if you listen, I know you listened, but last night we had a beautiful event on Zoom. It was the Shmuz. Some of you might have watched it. So I'll just give you the background, but it brings out this point very, very strongly. So there's a family here in Sydney. It's Bianca Hershowitz, is Ariella's sister. She lived in Dubai for quite a while. And she has 4 families that live in England that are friends of hers. And the 5 of them live in Dubai. This is before Abraham Accords, right? This is going back, I think some of them left in 2012, 2014, whatever it was, right? And they did a lot of stuff there in terms of building up the Jewish community, not in such a very public way, because in those days they weren't, right? You know. And we had them on Zoom last night. So through her, we arranged it all. We had this beautiful day, and they told the story. My son asked them questions, and they told their story. Fascinating and inspiring. But one of the most incredible things that came was like this, right? These were 5 families who went to Dubai, each with their own reason, business, career, whatever the case was, connected with other Jews, realized that there's no Yiddishkeit there if they don't make it happen. There weren't rabbis there or scholars, whatever the case is. And they made it happen, each of them in their own amazingly beautiful way, right? And they rose to the occasion. And they said themselves, they did things that they would otherwise not have done. They made a bar mitzvah in Dubai. They brought out a mohel to perform a bris in Dubai, right? I mean, nowadays it's okay, it's easy, but those days it was a shtickle difficult, and they had to make decisions. You know, what do? We keep under wraps. They didn't experience anti-Semitism really, but still, you know, when every guy's second name is Muhammad, it's a little bit difficult. So right. So the most amazing thing, right? And there were some takeaway lessons, I think, from this whole thing, and I spoke at the end and I sort of mentioned some of them, but I think this is it, right? We all do respond, we rise to the occasion when there's no one else to do it, when we know that it's absolutely critical, that if we don't do it, no one will, right? The challenge is getting into our mindset that we're always like that. If I don't do what I can do, no one's going to do it. Yeah, it might not be so noticeable. There might be other people doing lots of stuff. But if I don't do what I can do, no one's going to do it, and something is going to be lost. For me, and for the people that I could do it for. Right? And I thought that was... And the other lesson was, and I said this then, that's sort of, we said, we should all challenge ourselves with this. There's a famous thought from the previous Lubavitcher Rebbe who said, he was talking about teaching and inspiring others. He said that if someone learns the Hebrew alphabet and you learn an Aleph, right, you then have a responsibility to teach that Aleph to someone who hasn't even learned the Aleph yet, even though you still need to go learn yourself and do the Bet. And the answer is yes, you should. You should do the Bet. You should go and you should study more on the Bet and the Gimel and the Dalit and all that represents. But in the meantime, you've learned an Aleph, someone else hasn't learned an Aleph, you can give, right? And that came by so strongly last night. One of them said, like, you know, he couldn't teach them the great scholarship of the Torah, but he could make the filter fish for the other people around. And they did that. He stood every Friday and he did it with his children, the most amazing experience, and they kept Yiddishkeit going, even a place like Dubai, right? And that's true on all levels. We can all do something because we all have something that someone else doesn't have. We all have an Aleph that someone else doesn't. So we all have a responsibility to each other, all as individuals, right? And what happens, unfortunately, and this is, I think, the takeaway from 2020, right? From 2020, is that sometimes we're not sure exactly what to do. So what do? We spend a lot of time around tables, around discussions with our families, obsessing and criticizing and discussing who got it right communally, right? I mean, I do this also. We all do this, right? You know, New South Wales versus Victoria in the States, New York versus Florida, America versus Switzerland. This one did it well, right? This one was good at it, right? Now, it's good news and it's interesting to know, and we all big chachamim about, you know, is lockdown's good, lockdown's not good, it's going to work, it's not going to work. Doesn't make much of a difference because at the end of the day, you elected these people around the country and they're going to do what they want anyway until the next election. So next election, you can decide. But really, it's actually of no consequence, right? Just look at Melbourne. If someone wants to put the lockdown in 5 days, he does it. You think it's a good idea, you can spend 2 hours thinking if it's a good idea or a bad idea. It actually doesn't make a difference, right? It happened. But what we can do is we can do what we can do. But we tend not to do that because it's too hard to confront. So what we do is we obsess about what the community response should be, instead of really taking time and thinking about what can I do, right? Now, these assumptions that I said before that we don't do because we don't know what to do, or we think it's not significant, or we're not sure what to do, what's going out of our comfort zone, of course, they're all incorrect, rather incorrect assumptions, for many reasons. First of all, we know that in terms of responses, it is good for us. Each individual needs to give. We've said this many times in the past, that there's a fascinating law in the Talmud about giving, the laws of charity, where we find that people who are, there's, you know, in the Talmud there was a whole welfare structure that was prevalent in community, Jewish-run communities. And the law was that when someone has nothing to his name or her name, and they need to depend on the communal fund or the communal kitchen, so there's a whole responsibility, there's a whole sort of protocol of, you know, a person is, it says in the Talmud, a person is entitled, if they don't have any funds on their own, they're entitled to partake from the communal funds, and you're supposed to give them enough for 15 meals a week. But you know why cheshbon of 15 meals? Because in the olden times, they used to have 2 meals a day, and on Shabbat, there was the third meal. So that's why it's 15 meals, right? Basic clothing, and so on and so forth. Basic needs, the Talmud goes through the basic needs that we should be providing for people who don't have. One of those basic needs is we have to give them a little bit extra money for them to give tzedakah, for them to give charity. It's the most amazing thing. What's the point of that? I mean, it's just going to be recycled again, right? And the point is because everyone has to give. Everyone has to give. And when you give, you learn that you have other things you can give that aren't money. You can give emotional support. You can give insight. You can give advice. You can give excitement, whatever. You can give a smile. There's lots of things we can give, right? But everyone has to give. And that's such an important thing, number one. Number two, we know that it's not the quantity of what we give. This is what we fail to understand sometimes. Sometimes small things can be so significant because they're impactful. First of all, they're good for us because we're giving. And it's a gift that God gave us that we all can give, and it doesn't really matter how much. I mean, obviously, if a person has more, they should give more. But the act of giving is as important, no matter what a person is giving, which is something we find very clearly from this week's parasha. Parasha that we're going to read this coming week in Shul. This week's parasha is Truma. What do we read in Truma? We read the building of the Mishkan. Now again, Rabbi Sachs points out one of his articles, a beautiful thing. He says, it's an obvious thing, but sometimes you don't pay attention to things that are really obvious. He says, when God told the Jewish people to build a Mishkan, right, there was a sudden shift. What was the shift? The shift was that God took the Jewish people out of Egypt. What did they do? Nothing. They just followed. But which was amazing. At the time, it was amazing. The faith that they had to follow was incredible. They came to the Kriyat Yamsa, they came to the sea. What did they do? Nothing. Hashem said, don't do anything. Just wait. I'll take care of it for you. Came to Har Sinai, the Matan Torah, God's given the Torah. Just show up. Even that, the Midrash says, they overslept. But they came a bit late, which is one of the reasons that people have a custom to stay up on the night of Shavuot to fix the oversleeping that the Jewish people had, right? Okay. But nothing. Later on, he tells them to build a Mishkan. Suddenly, there's a shift. God said, okay, enough. I can do it all myself. But that's not the point. I've carried you till now. I took you out of Egypt. I brought the 10 plagues. I split the sea and I gave you the Torah. Now, you build. And how was it built? It was built in a way where the mitzvah in this week's parasha is truma. Truma means to give. Truma means also to lift up, laharim. You all have to lift up and you have to give. What do you have to give? So there was a minimal tax of half a shekel. But other than that, you all give. These are the materials we need to build the Mishkan. Everyone gives whatever they can give. And there was no hierarchy. They didn't have plaques on the Mishkan saying this one was built by the gold one, the bronze one. And the other one. No, all the Jews were equal. Why? Because giving is equal. Because it's not the amount, it's the what you put into it. It's the care. You know what's a fascinating thing? You know that one of the things in the Torah we have is korbanot, sacrifices, which is a separate discussion, understanding what it is, but it plays a very big role in Jewish thinking, in Jewish practice, in the time of the Beit HaMikdash. And there were different types of sacrifice. There were animals, there were flower offerings, there were all different types, right? Bird offerings. And often the different offerings had to do with the affordability of the person. See, someone could afford to give a nice gesunte animal, which costs more, he should, right? What happens to a very, very poor person? He can't afford an animal, but he wants to bring a carbon. He wants to come close to God. He wants to give something to the temple. So there's a flower offering. A little bit of flour. There's a kind of laws how you can bring a little bit of flour offering. A bag of flour is affordable, right? And we find an amazing expression in the Torah. Amazing expression. Whenever it comes to a sacrifice, it says, Adam ki yakriv, a person who will offer up the sacrifice. When it comes to the flour offering of flour, it says, Nefesh ki takriv, the soul who will bring. And the Talmud says, you know why? Because the flour offerings were the poor people's offerings. For them, that shtickle flour was their whole soul. And God said, that's most important. That's the most important sacrifice. Because when they give, it's hard. And they're giving their nefesh, they're giving their soul. So it's not about the amount, it's about the care we put into it. It's about the enthusiasm, it's about the focus, it's about doing it, it's about going a little bit beyond ourselves. It's about thinking of a world outside of our world. That's what it is, right? So God gives us the gift in this week's parasha, and he says, the gift is, you've got to give. I'm done. I'm done taking care of you. Now I'm giving you the gift, the ultimate gift. Up to now it wasn't possible. You were immature. It's like a child. A child doesn't give. A child you have to care for, right? Which is why giving is so difficult sometimes, because a child, right, all our children, for the first, I don't know, 5 years of their life at least, they're just taken care of, right? They give a kvetch in the middle of the night and everyone runs to pick them up, right? So that we're giving, they're completely taken care of, but then that's the child. When we left Egypt, we were like children. But now God says, okay, that's fine. Now you're mature. Now it's time to learn to give. Because that's the individual, and everyone. I don't want a board of the Mishkan to just take care of the fundraising. There's a fund. Everyone has got to come. Everyone has got to give. And whatever one gives, if you're giving, the expression uses there in the Torah is Asher Yidvenu Libo, that your heart will donate. As long as your heart gives it, and you translate that heart into some action, whatever you can, but it's coming from your heart, that's good. But you've got to give. Everyone, every individual has to give. Right? We're coming, next week is Purim. Right? So Purim is about, not only about a collective response. The decree was against a nation. Haman plotted against the entire nation. But how do we celebrate Purim? Not just to do nation things. Not just to do group things, right? We celebrate Purim by giving. Each individual has to give. What do we give? Big things? No. The mitzvot of Purim is the easiest mitzvah to do. You take an apple and a hamantash and you give it to a friend, you've done a mitzvah. You take 2 10-cent coins and you give it to two poor people or to a fund that will distribute it to. Obviously, if you give more, it's better, but a little bit, it's the mitzvah of Purim. As long as we give. Part of the celebration, part of the happiness of Purim, right? Because in Purim, the way it works is we listen to the Megillah, then we do the mitzvot of giving gifts of food and matanot levyanim, and then we have a festive meal. Because God says you can only sit down to your festive meal if you first create a culture of giving. Everyone, every individual has to give. Right? Every man, every woman, every child, everyone has to give. Not a lot. A fruit basket, one even. It's enough, a little bit. Right? A little bit of money to help the poor, but as long as it's giving. Purim is very much about a culture of giving. When the culture of giving and there's food circulating and there's staka circulating and so on and so forth, then it's a happy time, and then you could sit down to your Purim Seudah, your festive meal, and really, really celebrate. The most important thing is that, number one, as individuals, we have to give because it's good for us. But the other thing to bear in mind is that we never can know the effect of what we, of the things that we give, right? Which is the second part. So we have to give whether small or big. And we all have to respond. We all have an individual responsibility to respond and to help someone else or to do something purposeful in response to something that happens. But whether small or big, that's okay. Whatever we can, a little bit more than we can, right? Because it's always good to push ourselves. But the other thing is we never know how impactful it can be. And I want to end off with an unbelievable story and then get to the punchline of what I really want to bring out. So there's a story I heard a while ago. I like telling stories from this person because there's a guy called Yoel Gold, Rabbi Yoel Gold. Some of you might have heard stories of me before. He's a rabbi somewhere in America. And he has this obsession with stories. And because, you know, that's how it goes. So once he started telling stories, people know that he tells stories. So everyone, every time someone has a really good story, they share it with him. But what I like about him is, you know, people tell stories that, as I say, in Yiddish, nishki shtoigen, nishki flegen, which means it could have happened, might have happened, and, you know, someone thought it happened, but it didn't really happen, right? But they're nice stories anyways, but he researches his stories. And he's done, like, he does a lot of work on his stories. He interviews the people, and he interviews, like, people who it happened to. And So... when he tells a story, I kind of trust it, and it's in him. But if it wouldn't be him, I'm not sure I would believe the story, because it's actually an unbelievable story. So the story is about a girl who, at the time of the story, was about 23. He didn't publish her name, so he gave her another name. He called her Hannah Weinstock. Okay, so we'll call her Hannah. Who was in Israel. I think she's originally American, but she was in Israel. And she went for Shabbat to Tzfat. She was going to be in Tzfat for a few days. And she decided on Sunday that she's going to go home to Yerushalayim a little bit early because she wasn't feeling the greatest, whatever. So she took a bus all the way back. She lives in Har Nof. She gets to Har Nof. She's happy to be home, and she's going to go to sleep when she gets a call from a friend in Haifa. A friend who asks her, says like this, "I'm doing a project, an assignment, what the assignment was, a particular thing, and I need a picture. I need you to do me a big favor. I need a picture of the Temple Mount in Jerusalem, but from a particular angle. To do this picture, you have to go to Mount Olives, Har HaZeitim, right? Which is a little bit East Jerusalem sort of thing. I mean, people go there, and it's like 5 minutes away from, I don't know, Shar Shechem, I think. And take a bus, you take a picture." She wasn't feeling the greatest, but a friend asks, "You know, I'll do the favor." So she gets up, she goes to the thing in Shar Shechem, you take a bus. But she wasn't feeling the greatest, and she wasn't focused. And she took the wrong bus. She took an Arab bus rather than the Israeli bus. Okay. Not only that, she gets on the bus, not really noticing. She really wasn't feeling that great. Sits down. It was supposed to be a 5-minute ride. She falls asleep, and she wakes up 25 minutes later. She wakes up. She's deep in the middle of East Jerusalem, in like a real intense Palestinian Arab sort of community. She gets on the bus, she doesn't know what to do, right? So she figures the first thing she's going to do is take a bus the other way around. She gets up, she can't find a bus stop. Right? Unbeknown to her, it was also the first night of Ramadan. So it was towards evening. No one was in the street because everyone was at home feasting. She starts to look around. You know, not all of them are bad, but there's some very bad stuff there. There's pictures of pictures praising terrorists. You know, they have these pictures of people that have had bombs. And she's in the wrong area, right? So what does she do? She starts to daven. First of all, she takes out her phone. She takes out her phone, she gets some help, and her phone died, out of battery, right? So she starts to daven, says Tehillim, but she realizes that davening alone is not enough. There's going to be a miracle, hopefully, but you've got to do something, right? So she decides, listen, she hasn't got a choice, right? She's going to have to find a house which looks the most normal, that has the least posters that are negative on it, and knock at the door. What she did, right? So she's walking a bit, and she finds a house like that. And she had a plan. Her plan was like this. She's going to not let on she knows any Hebrew. She's going to pose as a girl from California who's a social justice something or other, who's doing research into the plight of the Arabs or the Palestinians. You know, anything that'll get her out of trouble, right? And she is all ready to have this whole story. Knocks on the door, and a young Palestinian, sort of her age, girl answers the door, looks at her and says, Hannah? So she got completely bamboozled because she wasn't planning to say her name. And she didn't know what to do, but the girl schleps her in, takes a card off a shelf and says, Yesh li eta kartisa dain, I still have the card. And takes her second, what she's talking about. What happened? This is the story. Unbelievable story. This girl, Hannah, had a whole group in one of the hotels near East Jerusalem. I think it's King Solomon Hotel, whatever. She had a whole group there from Eishet Torah. She was running a group for a few days. An education group, they were teaching, whatever the case, a bunch of Jewish, large Jewish group. And when she was in the hotel, she decided, she's not a wealthy girl, she wasn't able to leave big tips for the staff, but she decided what she could do is, she's going to pay an interest in all the staff members, the cleaners, the waitresses, the receptionists, right? Create a connection with them, conversation with them, get their names, get their details. And at the end, she was going to leave everyone a card and say thank you. The last day she was there, she sees like a receptionist. And there were a lot of like Arab workers there. I mean, a lot of them work in the hotels and stuff like that. The last day, she sees a receptionist who she didn't notice. That's like a new person, right? Must be a new... So she decides she's got to keep her thing. So she goes over. She says, how are you? My name is Hannah. What's your name? Tells her name, whatever. I start talking. She says she's actually a student. She wants to become a doctor. In the meantime, she has to save up some money. So she's doing a bit of work in the hotel. And while she's thinking about this and while she's in the house, she hasn't yet told him that she's lost. She didn't want to let on now. She got lost and she's actually petrified. The reason that the girl thought she was there is because before she left, she gave her a card and said thank you. Like a nice card. She said, I can't give you a tip, but I want to show gratitude. So I gave you a card. And this girl said, you know, let's stay in touch. And if you ever need Jerusalem, come visit. So this girl opens the door. She thinks that she kept her thing. Hannah's come to visit. So she pulls her. She says, oh, so nice to see you. So she decided she's going to play the game a little bit. And she says, yeah. So she's thinking, and then she's talking to them. And she comes in. Please meet my whole family. Nice family. Very good family. It's been and all good. And she's talking, and then she says, you know, I actually really have to get back to where I'm staying. Is there a bus back? So they said, no, actually, there's no buses running there. Because I guess Ramadan, everyone's at home, but there's no bus running there. But my uncle will drive you. So tells the story that the uncle gets in the car with the girl, with the friend that she met at the hotel. Not relevant to the point I want to bring up, but the funny part of the story is they actually got stopped at a checkpoint. The guy looks and sees an Israeli girl there with two Palestinians, says to the girl, are you okay? She says, yeah, 100%, no problem, all good. Let them through. And she said, why? Because she paid attention to someone. That's all, right? I mean, it's a miraculous story. I mean, because as we know, I mean, again, not all people are bad, God forbid, and God forbid to say that, but there are stories that people land up in these areas and don't come out, right? And it was a miraculous thing. But why did it happen? Because she did something that wasn't amazing. Just paid attention, said hello, and showed a little bit of gratitude, right? A little bit of gratitude, that's all. So what's the lesson for us? The lesson for us is like this. I think, number one, we have to have an individual response to everything. We all have to respond. But in order to know how to respond, we also have to think a little bit and reflect, right? And we have to know that the smallest thing can do amazing things. And I say that particularly because we have an opposite challenge here in Australia, and I think in New South Wales particularly. And let me share this with you, what I've heard from people, right? A lot of us haven't done it that tough. A lot of people tell you actually they enjoyed the lockdown while it was happening. We do live in a different planet here. I mean, last night it was interesting. On that call, I realized towards the end, before they go, I should wish them in London that everything should turn around, because, you know, I'm sitting here, we were having a Zoom call with people in London, and I'm suddenly realizing, like, these people aren't completely, we're on the same call, discussing the same topic, they're in a completely different situation than we are. Completely locked down, it's completely crazy. You know, so thank God I remembered that towards the end. But so here we do live in a different planet, and things are now, for now at least, and please God it should continue, things are pretty much back to normal. But you know what the problem is? The problem is that everything's back to normal, and I think people are still suffering, and people are scared to say it. It's almost embarrassing to say you're doing it tough. Because, you know, Sydney is not, right? But there are lots and lots of people that are still really suffering emotionally. Uncertainty, anxiety has gone up everywhere, including New South Wales, right? Why? Because whichever way you cut it, it's been a year of uncertainty. Even when we have a little Northern Beaches breakout, and then we have a couple of restrictions we have to keep for a few weeks, some people respond very badly. I've spoken to people. Because it's, again, like, it's uncertain, and their plans got ruined, and they had a wedding, and or just uncertainty generally, right? Some people have done it very tough financially. A lot of financial things haven't worked this year. Some have, some haven't, right? Yesterday I heard from someone who spoke to a psychiatrist, a very good psychiatrist, who said they've closed their booking. They're not taking any more patients. They are so busy. I heard from a doctor in Melbourne that she refers children for therapy. She cannot get an appointment. There's no, around her, there's no psychologists that have any bookings. Okay, Victoria's probably a bit worse than here, but it's all here too, right? So there are people in distress, and I think the problem is that we're not noticing it enough, and I think people are scared to come out and say it. I don't have scientific evidence for this, but that's my assumption. Why? Because we're doing it so well. And sometimes our own selves, we talk ourselves into this, that we're doing fantastically, and we're not maybe. I noticed myself, there were times that I realized, you know, actually I'm not doing that well. There were times that were tough, right? And you need to deal with that by reaching out to someone else. But we need to do it both ways. And I think that's part of the individual response that we have to do. Obviously, we have to respond personally, not only giving. We have to all grow. We have to learn the lessons. We all have to become better. But we all have to, even now, we have to do those little things. We have to call people. We have to reach out to people. We have to just pay an interest with other people. You know? And we never know what calling up someone, just a little phone call and saying, how are you doing? Or just paying a little bit more attention to people. We all can improve on this, right? We never know where that can lead. I thought I'd share with you a story, because it's a really beautiful story, but it also brings out that incredible point. You just never know what a card for someone can do, what a phone call could do, what a hello could do, what a smile could do. We just never, ever know. So we all have a responsibility. The point is, like, going back to Mount Sinai. Yes, God made a nation. There's a community, and community has its responsibilities. Governments have their responsibilities. Communal leaders have their responsibility, and that's critical. But we all have a responsibility. We have the individual response. Vayikra, it's a call to action. Whatever happened to 2020 was a call. We just shouldn't miss the aleph. Anochi Hashem Elokecha, God says, nothing's by chance, everything has a purpose, but I'm talking to you. I'm not talking to the next guy. I'm talking to the community, but I'm talking to you individually. I'm calling you. How are you going to respond? We can't do big things. We can all do a little bit more than we do. We can all go a little bit more out of our comfort zone. And if we do, we can never know what effect it can have on us and on the other people. We'll stop there. Thank you. Have a wonderful day and a wonderful week. Thank you. All the best.
Thank you.
Wow, that's beautiful.
Just this
morning. Yeah, it's fine. That's fine. Thank you. Have a wonderful day, everyone.
Thank you.
You're welcome.